SeaRealm Vault Podcast, episode number 400, Saturday, May 29th, 2021.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey, everybody. Odometer moment. SeaRealm Vault Podcast, episode number 400, double zeros. Yay. Anyway, moving on. This is the follow-up, or the conclusion, I should say, to my recent conversation with Thaddeus Russell. We had talked about Pax Americana, the United States as a global empire, a military empire, a cultural empire, and he acknowledged some of the strengths and benefits of the U.S. and particularly the role it played in the fight against Soviet communism in the 20th century. And that's where we pick up. And I think he said all that with the expectation that I would then allow him to go on and say why he's still against empire, but I changed the subject. So that's where the conversation picks up.
Yeah, do you want to do the other side now, or do you just want to leave it at that? Do you want to do the nonetheless choose to be anti-imperialist after all that?
Sure.
Do you? I don't know. Where do you want to go?
Well, actually, the question I wanted to ask, I don't know exactly how old you are, but I get the impression we're about the same age. I'm 53.
I'm 55.
Okay. Cool. I was born in 68, graduated high school in 86.
Finally, I get to talk to someone who's not 35. Have you noticed this? Have you noticed that everyone in our world's 35? Some 35-year-old dude. Everybody in there.
My audience is mostly boomers. And
is it really?
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. I wish I had more boomers. I have no boomers. Huh. Okay.
Well, there's a lot of millennials, so they're not to be, turned away.
My audience is
listen to this podcast.
90% 35-year-old guys. Yeah. All right.
But I would just ask you, looking back on your 55 years of life, looking at the big picture, talking about politics, talking about economics, talking about technology, how would you describe the trajectory of your life? What have you lived through?
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
My life itself or the world around me?
I'm interested in your opinion about what's happened in the world since you've been on it.
Oh, so it is the world around me.
Yeah.
How has the world changed during my life? Is that the question?
Yeah. But in answering it, you're telling me what's important to you, what lens.
Yeah.
Through.
Okay. So I think there were two. God, there's a lot to choose from. But to me, what stand out, the internet, obviously, mm-hmm. The advent of the internet, it's got to be number one in terms of importance, effect, impact, the profundity of the change. That's just, that's an endless topic. It's that important. And then I do think that, I do think Trump was a major rupture. The whole phenomenon, I don't mean just him, I mean just everything having to do with him. Something I've never seen before. Unprecedented in American history. He's getting a package. KMO is getting a package while I'm trying to pretend he's not.
Well, I'm laughing because you the first thing that came to mind, what's happened in your life? The internet. It's an Amazon.
Oh, yeah, there it is. Amazon showed up at the door and he goes to get a box. He's just illustrating the point. That's all. That's all that
I'm
going
to mute again though, because I got screaming kids outside.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, Trump, the Trump phenomenon is we've never seen this before in American history. And people simply did not speak the way that Trump spoke at anywhere near president, not even senators. Congress people spoke like that. Mayors, not even them. And he violated so many norms, some of which are somewhat trivial and some of which are very trivial, like, you know, do you dye your hair a garish color? To should we have NATO and everything in between? He's violated all those norms. And the norms, obviously, he hit enough important. The norms he hit at it were important enough that the entire FBI and CIA essentially conspired to bring him down. And that's what happened. I mean, and that's, I've never said it that way, but that is what that was. That was the FBI and CIA conspiring to lead a movement to depose Trump. There's no doubt about that. It started with them. They stoked the cultural movement against Trump, which was about his hair color and his naughty words and all that. But what was really driving it was that he was fucking with the American empire. Back to that. It was, to me, that's really why he went down, was that he messed with the American empire. I think he would have survived if he had had normal neocon, neoliberal foreign policies, or statements at least. But he, when he started talking about NATO, he signed his death warrant with the FBI and CIA. They cannot tolerate that. That's their reason for being, raison d'etre. So, you know, and we know this, we do know that the FBI and CIA and NSA, they basically coordinated the whole thing. They fed everything about Russiagate directly to the New York Times. Like, that was it. You know, we know that. So, pretty amazing. But that's the American empire is at the center of everything. Last thing I'll say about this, you know, the American empire, it declared its commitment to eternity after 1991 and then redeclared that after 9/11. But, you know, the Clinton thing was a very big deal in doubling down on NATO after the reason for NATO ceases to exist. And then, as you said, it's like close to 800 military bases across the world now. So, like, the number of military bases has increased tremendously as well. So, I mean, that's the other thing that's happened during my lifetime, in the last 55 years, that I think those are the three biggest I would point to. Pretty big.
Well, when I look back on that period, I think, one, we got through the Cold War. There was no nuclear war.
Yeah.
Yay. Victory.
Nice one. Yeah, that's a good one.
But that's the last good thing I have to say, really. the internet, yeah, wonderful. Since we've gotten it, we've grown to hate each other. And, you know, it's basically a conduit through which powerless people can rail at each other and castigate one another.
Do you think that's really true, though? Do you think there's actually more hatred now than there was before?
It seems like we're more tribal, but that could be because of other circumstances. But I think the internet facilitates it. But the thing that's most important to me when I'm looking at it from my perspective, you know, of my position in society, is when I was born in 68, height of the Cold War, we could have all died in a nuclear incineration. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We didn't. Good. But when I was born, a guy could graduate from high school, get a job, not a super sophisticated, high profile job, just a job. And on that one job, he could get married. He could buy a house. He could support his stay at home wife. They could send their kids to college, buy new cars every now and again, take vacations. And now it's two people working their asses off.
Yeah.
Or it's three or four people who aren't married and aren't related, but are, you know, under the same roof because it's the economic necessity.
Yeah.
And the middle class, you know, I wonder if it was just a historical anomaly. Like, for most of history, it didn't exist. It did for a couple generations after World War II, and now it's not going to anymore.
Okay, here's the thing. So I'll offer you a trade. Okay, so I'll give you that job you're just talking about?
Well, I don't want it, but I'm a weirdo.
Oh, you don't want it. Yeah, exactly.
I can get a job now and make a lot more money than I do.
First of all, let's talk about where that job is, most likely. What kind of a job is that? It's in a factory.
Right.
It's in a factory, guys. That's the kind of job you're talking about. By the way, this is what Bernie and Trump both wax rhapsodically about, is bringing back factory jobs. They actually say that. It's just horrifying. Both those, it's like, fuck both of you. No, thank you. But let's say it's not a factory job, although it is, but let's say it's a decent office job, which it might be. Because this is the trade. I'll give you that job with that good solid salary, you know. I'll even put it in an office. You get to wear a collar to work. But you don't get to have the internet. But you don't really get to fly more than like once or twice in your life because you can't afford more than that. You might have air conditioning. You probably don't. 1950s, most people did not have air conditioning. You have a very tiny black and white television, maybe. Your car doesn't start about 1 out of 20 or 30 times. You try to turn it on. There is racial segregation in the country you live in. drugs are not only illegal, they're like really, 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 really illegal. Do I need to go on? So in other words, I think that people are actually far wealthier now than they were then.
When you measure like the size of my TV, it's freaking huge. And when I worked at Amazon.com early on, I got stock options, and after 2 years I quit and I had a bunch of money, which I had what to me was a bunch of money.
Wow. Uh-huh.
And I spent like $4,000, I think, on a TV, a really big TV. Damn. But it was cathode ray TV.
Jesus.
Two big burly men to get it into the house. Last year I paid $250. I ordered a TV off Amazon. The screen is much bigger than that $4,000 TV.
$250? That's all?
And, it just got mailed. It's not heavy at all. My building was locked. I couldn't get deliveries. So there's a couple older women I know who offered to let me send packages to their place, and they could easily carry it over here. Just took one of them. It weighs nothing. Like the box it came in weighs as much as it does. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. It's an amazing piece of technology. I just praise my Huawei cell phone all the time. I have a 3-year-old Huawei Mate SE. It cost $220 when I got it. It is amazing. It is an amazing piece of technology. I love it. So, I know I'm fully on board with, we have stuff that was science fiction back then, but then I'll bring up the David Graeber argument. We were promised moon colonies and jetpacks and flying cars, and we got Twitter.
No. Hold on. I just said we got air conditioning and we got TVs and poor people, cars. Something like 95% of all Americans have access to a car. Like basically everyone has access to a car. 99% of Americans have air conditioning. Like that shit is crazy. Meaning massive improvements in the quality of life for poor people.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's an improvement in the quality of life. I mean, I've had a car most of my life. I don't right
air
now.
Air conditioning? Air conditioning?
I've lived without it. You get used to it.
Oh, my God.
But when I was in the third grade, I lived in California. I lived in Pleasant Hill. It's a suburb of San Francisco.
Yeah, the weather's perfect there.
Yeah, the weather's perfect.
You don't need air conditioning.
I rode my bike to school, and I was expected to be home by dinner. But the hours between the end of school and dinner and all day in the summer, I was on my bike out in the world, traversing a physical environment, exploring, getting into wrecks, getting hurt, getting into fights, getting into trouble. But I was, a kid, a kid of elementary school age. I was unattended, by myself, out in the world, an autonomous entity. My kids did not experience that. My kids were at home in front of a screen.
Right.
They've spent the last year in their rooms on the internet.
Mine too.
Not stepping outside their front door for months on end.
Mine too.
And that is an impoverished existence compared to what I had. And, you know, when I was their age, then I had a car and I was a teenager and I was drinking and I was getting into adventures and into trouble. I got arrested as a teenager.
I mean, look, I have the same feeling, you know, we're the same age, basically. My son is 19, same age as your kids, basically. Right. Mm-hmm. I have the exact same like instinct, but I do think it's an instinct. And I do think it's the same instinct that our parents had about us and their parents had about them and their parents had about, you know what I mean? Every generation is like, oh my God, Elvis Presley is going to destroy American civilization, you know, like, and then
I'm not railing against the culture. I'm just railing against the trading of genuine, real embodied experience.
Well, but no,
relation.
But no. But see, that's the thing. They are relating all day long. Like my son plays video games for hours, but he's talking to four of his friends from who live in New York. We used to live in New York and from New York City, like while he's doing it. So he's even keeping up with like old friends. Right. And they're actually like doing an activity together too. They're not just like having a conversation, you know? And like, how is that? Why is that worse than I know, dude, I'm with you. Like, but like, how is it, how can you prove to me that it's worse? That's what I mean. How can you prove to me that it's worse than taking a walk in the woods together?
I would appeal to your embodied self. I mean, you have an animal body that is evolved and adapted to interact with the material world. You've got software that is exquisitely optimized to recognize, first to recognize a face when you see one, and then to scrutinize it for micro expressions to figure out friend or foe. And if it's a friend, what kind of friend? And, you know, how much can I trust this person? And I just don't think that playing Call of Duty together online is equivalent.
Well, it's not equivalent. I know they're different things. I'm saying,
in my opinion, and I'm happy to own it as an opinion, it's inferior.
I know. Well, okay. I'm asking for proof.
You want an argument for it to be inferior.
How can you prove? Yeah, right. Exactly.
And again, I'm just appealing to your appreciation of what an exquisitely refined vehicle you ride around in terms of, you know, the one with the arms and the legs and it's amazing. And so much of its capabilities go unused when you're just staring at the screen, talking into the microphone, pushing buttons with your thumbs.
The body you're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm really good at playing devil's advocate. You may have found this out about me.
What happens when two devil's advocates get together and have a conversation?
Right. That's a good one. I don't even know. Like, what's the algebra there? I don't know. There's an equation.
Well, there's a random starting position, and one person takes a position, and then the other person opposes them. And
where do they end up, though?
Yeah.
What does that equal? You know what I mean? DA plus DA equals what? Where were we?
we've been on for an hour and 17 minutes, so we can bring it to a conclusion.
Yeah, well, I didn't know there was something there, though. What was the last thing? Just bring me back.
Well, I was saying, in my day, we did real stuff out in the world.
Oh.
And you said, yeah, well, now kids are doing stuff that you didn't have access to, and it's pretty cool stuff. I'm like, yeah, it is pretty cool stuff.
Oh,
but it's not as good.
The body. Yeah. Your love of moving the body. Well,
a real environment.
Okay. But again, you're privileging those things, valuing them, and it's all subjective. I know you know that, but it is. And I'm not even going to make that argument because that's boring. How about this? Yeah, sucker. Like, you're like getting up and like basically working. You're basically getting up, walking, running, doing all these things. There's a lot of work involved in the play that you and I did. I did a lot of walking through the woods, the exact stuff you're talking about. But, you know, it was also, there was a lot of like boring, long, strenuous stretches where you didn't really get anything out of it, you know, and you just did all this fucking work. You walked for miles and miles and miles and miles and miles and nothing cool happened. You know, tons of boredom, lots of sitting around, standing around, walking around, being bored. But yeah, using the body, going back and forth. You know, I used to have to walk back and forth across the city of Berkeley to go to school. Like, I don't think that was necessarily a better thing. My son is experiencing a billion times more stuff by being on his phone. He is, because he can go anywhere, and he does. He goes everywhere on the phone. He does. And whereas I was just going back and forth on Shattuck Avenue over and over again, like, who fucking cares after the, you know, after the 70th time? That's just, you know, there's my attempt. Do what you will, or we can finish this at another time. This has been really fun, by the way. Really fun.
About the world that I grew up in. I mean, it, of course, everybody's going to say the world was legit when I was young. Music was better. Movies were better.
Right.
But, you know, look back at the 1980s. The movies were better.
No.
The 1980s was a golden age of sci-fi and action films.
What? The 70s was the gold. It's called the golden age. That's what they call it.
I mean, we got Alien in 1979, which I consider to be the 80s, basically. But yeah.
Well, sci-fi, sure. If you're limiting it to sci-fi, of course, you know, 80s is better. But I mean,
When I visit my kids, I make them watch Aliens or The Thing.
I love Aliens.
You know,
man.
Those films, and my kids are amazed when they watch them. It's like, well, there's no CGI. The effects are kind of hokey, but man, the pacing is just perfect. The characterizations are just so accessible.
Star Wars still holds up. Wars fucking holds up from 1976. It does.
Every time George Lucas revises it, he makes it worse.
It holds the original. You watch that, it's not boring to the eyes of, I've seen millennials and Zoomers watch Star Wars, the 1976, and be like, oh wow, this is actually pretty cool looking. Like, it works. It's amazing. I still don't understand how it did.
And it looks so good because so much of it is real in camera.
I guess so. I guess so.
Ralph McQuarrie, amazing conceptual artist.
But that's an amazing achievement.
Yep.
That's a really amazing achievement. I have no idea how they did it. I guess you did. Now, all right, man.
I will say I absolutely love the animated Star Wars stuff that is continuing to this day.
Yeah.
The Dave Filoni universe with, you know, Ahsoka Tano, Clone Wars, Star Wars Rebels, and now The Bad Batch. I love that stuff. I used to watch it with my kids. They outgrew it. I haven't.
Not my bag. I only like the very, very top cream of the sci-fi crop. I'm not a fan of the genre. I only like the stuff. I only like the top like three, you know, movies.
Well, but I don't consider Star Wars to be sci-fi. I mean,
I love them.
Space fantasy adventure.
But how is it not science fiction?
It doesn't deal with any scientific concepts. It's not looking forward. I mean, it's a fantasy tale. It takes place long ago. You know,
You have to have science in science fiction.
Yeah.
Yeah, oh really?
It's a space opera. It's an adventure tale.
That's how much I know. I've never read any science fiction. Zero. Sorry.
So when you say the cream on top, what are you referencing?
I mean, like the ones that like crossed over that became like super, like Alien, like those that became like very popular.
Alien, I don't think of as a science fiction film either. I mean, it's the best Lovecraft movie we've ever gotten.
Oh. I mean, don't normies call those sci-fi? Aren't they in the sci-fi category on Netflix?
Oh, probably, but...
Okay, good. Yeah. I'm not so stupid. You're making me feel like I was a complete knucklehead. Yeah, what on Netflix is classed as sci-fi? It would only the ones that are the top. But like, I love those. But I love those movies. You know, the ones that are really good, I really love.
Did you like Her? Did you see that?
I haven't seen it. I've heard great things about it, though.
Joaquin Phoenix and
I know I should watch that. I
mean, yeah, that's science fiction,
right? Because it's dealing with like artificial intelligence or whatever. Okay.
Yeah, you absolutely should watch that. It's amazing.
Okay, I will now. Thank you.
No worries. All right. Well, we're bringing it to an unceremonious end, but this has been a lot of fun. Thanks a lot.
It has. Totally. Thank you so much, man.
All right.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye.
That was Thaddeus Russell. Now, you probably won't be surprised to hear that as I edited the conversation, you know, listening to it again, we were taking different sides of, you know, a point of disagreement. And of course, it occurred to me to say more, you know, to refute or to rebut what he had said. But, you know, with the benefit of leisurely hindsight. And as you know, it's just not my practice. So while I certainly have more to say on the topics that we were discussing, I'm not going to say them here. Instead, I'm going to back up and I'm going to talk more about that debate, the Peter Munk debate. Munk, if you want to look it up, is spelled M-U-N-K, not like a, you know, somebody in a monastery. So in the main Sea Realm podcast episode where I introduced the idea, I didn't have the actual resolution that Stephen Bannon, Stephen K. Bannon, and David Frum were going to be debating. But I have since gone back and taken in large parts of that debate again. It's about an hour and a half long, beginning to end, with the opening announcements and thanks to various organizations and acknowledgments and all that good stuff. I mean, bells and whistles all together. It's about an hour and a half. I linked to it in the show notes for that Sea Realm podcast episode, but it's on C-SPAN. But if you just, you know, I hate to use the verb, but Google Bannon from Munk, M-U-N-K, you'll find it, no problem. But the resolution is, be it resolved, the future of Western politics is populist, not liberal. Much more concise than I presented it when I was just trying to pull it out of my memory. So I don't know who came up with that exact formulation of the resolution. And I don't know exactly what is meant by either populism or liberalism. And from my perspective, if you're going to have a debate, the first thing you do is clarify the terms of your debate. What is the point of disagreement that you have? This debate, while it is structured like a debate, each participant has a certain amount of time for opening remarks. Then there are shorter rounds, and it's timed, and there's a clock in front of them on the stage. So you'll hear, I think, at one point, Bannon end pretty much in mid-sentence because he realizes he just ran out of time. And unlike the presidential debates, there's only two people on stage, and they respect the time limits. You know, when the clock says zero, they stop talking. But, you know, without actually defining populist and liberal, how do you even approach a debate about whether or not the future of Western politics is populist and not liberal? And at the end of the debate, if you've never defined these terms, how do you score the debate? How do you decide who won? Well, this is a formal debate, and it is more civilized in how it's conducted than, you know, the presidential debates, which is, you know, the other debate that I think most of us are familiar with. And those aren't debates at all. I mean, they're called debates and people stand behind podiums, but, and you know, there are moderators who call on people, but there is no structure. There's no debate structure at all in the presidential debates. This one has a structure. It has a moderator. The moderator has latitude to decide, you know, how long to continue these rounds, these back and forth rounds. And the moderator actually does put his thumb on the scales a little bit for liberalism. I'm not going to cover that here though. For the most part, it was well done, but it's still a persuasive exercise done in front of an audience meant to appeal to the audience's prejudices. And part of that appeal, particularly for Frum, is to not define your terms. Again, Stephen Bannon, in his opening remarks, says the future is populist. The only question is, will it be nationalist populist, which is what Donald Trump is, or will it be socialist populist, which is Bernie Sanders and his agenda? Bannon wants it to be nationalist, so he's going to argue in favor of nationalism. But here, let's listen to the moderator introducing the two debaters, and in the process, he will give some indication as to what he believes liberalism is, or what he wants the audience to think liberalism is. Now, I think the moderator was pretty good about appearing impartial for most of the debate. He lets the mask slip toward the end. And he reveals himself to be clearly against Bannon. But at the beginning and through most of the debate, he does a pretty good idea of playing the disinterested, neutral third party. But here he is introducing the topic and the debaters, and in passing, his idea of what liberalism is.
Well, tonight's debate is happening, we all know, just days before these critical midterm elections, and it will tackle one of the most important issues facing the Western world, the rise of populist politics. We're going to ask tonight from these two debaters to answer some important questions. Is the West living through a populist sea change that will irrevocably transform our politics? And can these long-standing liberal values of trade, society, of politics, push back against this populist surge and reassert their primacy in the 21st century? Well, let's find out by getting this debate underway and getting our debaters out here center stage. Arguing in favor of tonight's resolution, be it resolved, the future of Western politics is populist, not liberal, is the former strategist to President Donald Trump and global populist campaigner Stephen K. Bannon. Speaking against tonight's motion, be it resolved, the future of Western politics is populist, not liberal, is the best-selling author, Atlantic Magazine senior editor, and staunch critic of President Trump and populist politics, Toronto's own David Frum.
Thank you, David. So, liberalism, it's
liberal values of trade, society, of politics.
It's society? What does that mean? What is society? But before, I want to play some parts of the actual debate for you. Actually, just one exchange, a very short exchange. But before I do that, let's just look at, you know, the first definitions that pop up. These are just the, you know, you ask Google, what is populism? You get this definition. A political approach that strives to appeal to ordinary people who feel that their concerns are disregarded by established elite groups. So, for example, the question is whether he will tone down his fiery populism now that he has joined the political establishment. It also means support for populist politicians or policies. For example, the government came to power on a wave of populism. Or the quality of appealing to or being aimed at ordinary people. For example, art museums did not gain bigger audiences through a new populism. All right, so the resolution here is that the future of Western is populism, not liberalism. Well, what's liberalism? Ask Google that question. What is liberalism? Liberalism, noun, willingness to respect or accept behavior or opinions different from one's own, openness to new ideas. Well, that's probably not what we're talking about here. We're talking about politics. So, definition number two, a political and social philosophy that promotes individual rights, civil liberties, democracy, and free enterprise. I think that's, you know, that's clearly the political definition of liberalism, but I don't think that's what David Frum is arguing for, and I don't think that individual rights, civil liberties, and democracy, and free enterprise are what Stephen Bannon is arguing against. So I think with liberalism here, we're going to have to intuit a little bit. We're going to have to read in to what they're talking about. So to do that, I want to play an exchange here. The first person you'll hear speaking is David Frum. Again, David Frum is not a Democrat. He is a Republican. I think he was a speechwriter for George W. Bush. He was a speechwriter for one of the Bushes. And he represents the Republican Party, the establishment Republican Party. You know, this is the party of Mitt Romney. This is the party of Jeb Bush. This is the boring, say-nothing politicians. Not so much the neocon party. Not so much the party of Dick Cheney, but he is a champion for normal politics of the mainstream, boring, suit-wearing Republican variety. And he's talking about, the topic is Donald Trump's new NAFTA. You know, one of the first things that Trump did when he came into office, one of the very first things he did was withdraw the United States from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And then he turned his attention to the North American Free Trade Agreement, and he renegotiated it in a way that he presented to the American people as being very favorable to the United States. And David Frum doesn't dispute that, but here's what he has to say about Trump renegotiating NAFTA, and then you'll hear Steve Bannon's response.
lot of responsible people surrounded Donald Trump and tried to encourage him to do as little damage as possible to the most important trading zone on Earth. And the good news is that although the president crashed into the podium and knocked the cell phone to the floor, the screen is not too badly damaged. And NAFTA is waiting there to be repaired and brought into the modern age when there are people with good faith who can do things like negotiate the digital economy, which none of which got done. No constructive work got done. All that was happened was that NAFTA was prevented from being destroyed. You know, one of the questions we talk about here tonight is nationalism and globalism. Globalism, supposed to be a bad word. You know, North American lungs breathe Chinese pollution. Russian missiles shoot down Malaysian airliners with European citizens aboard. The only way we're going to stop this planet from getting too hot for our species to live on is if we all work together. It's one planet. We love our countries. Only through countries can we exercise our democracy. But we work together with friends and partners. How did Donald Trump get NAFTA? By bullying people, not by treating them as partners. He's never been able to negotiate a win-win deal in his business career. So Canada and Mexico are less powerful than the United States. And in the past, America always said, even though that was true, obviously, we can work cooperatively together. But this idea of America first, or Hungary first, or France first, or Germany first, it gets progressively less attractive, doesn't it, as we name the other countries who are going to put themselves first. We left that behind to say, we are going to build a community of democratic nations who understand that, of course, there are clashing interests that have to be worked out, but we are stronger always when we work cooperatively, and that we can build peace and prosperity. That's a liberal idea. In the truest sense, because the thing we've been arguing about for 200 years is the relationship of human beings one of domination and oppression, or one of potential fruitful cooperation? And that is... that's the question on the ballot tonight.
And the populist nationalist movement in Europe, as I've gone around and met the leaders, and I'm not an advisor to these individuals. I've set up a group called the Movement to be kind of hopefully the interconnective tissue that can help them focus on the European parliamentary elections next year. Not one leader, haven't heard one, say they want to destroy the European Union. What they talk about is the sovereignty of their country. They want their countries back, and they want their countries to be sovereign entities. And they want their citizens to be empowered and not to kind of report to these transnational entities that have no accountability. The ECB and the EU. They want to make the European Union, not the United States of Europe, where Italy's like South Carolina and France is Georgia. They want to make it a collection of sovereign individual states that work together. Why is that so hard? And why is that demonized? Why is the nation state that's been with us, what, since the Treaty of Westphalia, is the central building block of our world? Why is all of a sudden the nation state so scorned? Why is the term nationalism so scorned and demonized? What people want is subsidiarity. They want as much control as they can have as citizens. And that's through the nation state. Donald Trump gave that back to the American people. I know you may mock and ridicule it, but the economic turnaround didn't come from Obama, and everybody in the United States knows that. The most progressive president in the United States, and he can't defend this, flooded the zone and bailed out the elite in our country. We have socialism in the United States for the very wealthy and the very poor, and a brutal form of Darwinian capitalism for everybody else. The devil catch the hindmost. That's what the future entails if we don't get this right in Trump's administration and further administrations. If we don't bring out the benefits of capitalism, if we allow the millennials are nothing but 18th century Russian serfs right now. They're better fed, they're better clothed, they're in better shape, they have more access to more information. They don't own anything and they're not gonna own anything. Because of what Obama did, they're 20% behind today where their parents were. and they live in a gig economy. They can't afford a house. There's no pension plans. There's no careers. That, by the way, is the biggest potential for our populist movement, is the millennials, because they're going to see the logic of what we are talking about. Once again, and David, this is, we are not saying we shouldn't have elections. We're not saying, you just don't like it now because the establishment Republicans can't win any elections. What you serve up in all your brilliance,
all right, so there's Steve Bannon. That's the Steve Bannon. If you watch cable news, any cable news other than Fox, Steve Bannon has been held up to you as the devil's emissary on earth, as just pure evil. And yet here he is talking about the same things that I'm talking about here all the time on the C. Brown podcast and here in the vault. The economic progression in lockstep with the political and the technological progression of this country and the world generally over the past 30, 40 years has seen enormous concentrations of wealth at the top, has seen a destruction, certainly a destruction of middle-class security, but I would say a destruction of the middle class generally, largely because the jobs that you didn't have to go to college to get, but which still paid a living wage, the sort of wage that let you buy a house and support a family and send your kids to college, those jobs got shipped overseas. I think that is a big element in the so-called liberalism that David Frum is defending against so-called populism, while never acknowledging that there is a nationalist populist movement and there is a socialist populist movement. David Frum never once, in the full 90 minutes of this whole presentation, never once acknowledged that populism meant anything other than MAGA and Donald Trump. And time and again, he just came back to insulting Donald Trump and appealing to this Toronto audience's pre-existing hatred of Trump. He just played to it continuously. And what was Stephen Bannon saying? He was saying, America first doesn't mean that everybody in the world should take an America first position. That would be absurd. What he's saying is that when you're interacting on a global scale or in an international framework, you want to have the interests of the people of your nation. You want to prioritize those. Whereas David Frum and people who argue in favor of elite governance and unelected layers of government atop national elected governments, you know, governing bodies like the UN, like the WTO, like the European Union, people at that level, the Davos set, you know, people who hold multiple passports, people who travel around the world all the time, they feel more solidarity with the people in their own class, and it's an international class, than they do with the people who live and almost never leave the country that issued their passport. What does David Frum have to say about millennials being the equivalent of Russian serfs? Only, you know, better fed, better educated, with more access to information, but they don't own anything and they won't own anything. What does David Frum say to that? He doesn't. He doesn't say anything about that. He doesn't acknowledge it. He doesn't care about that. So not everything Frum said is dead wrong. Yeah, if you're going to have a comprehensive, effective response to climate change, there's got to be an international element to it. But that doesn't mean that the international jet set gets to throw everybody else to the wolves. I mean, they fully intend to. They're in the process of doing it. They've been doing it. They don't intend to stop. But consider this. I mean, if you've surely encountered the caricature of Stephen Bannon as just evil, just pure evil, just, you know, Hitler's clone with a barely concealed, you know, rabid racist agenda, just waiting to open the concentration camps and herd everybody who isn't Lily White into them. I mean, you've encountered that stereotype of him. Think about where you encountered it. Who proposed this notion to you? Who gave you this stereotype and said, use this, take this, this is all you need to know? What else are they pushing? What else do they advocate? All right. On that same track, capital concentrating at the top, been happening continuously for the past 40 years, but it's been accelerating. And then in 2020, it just went into overdrive. I'm going to mostly summarize, but read a bit to you from a piece called The Billionaire Boom, How the Super Rich Soaked Up COVID Cash. This is from dailyuknews.com, and it was posted to the C Realm podcast discussion group on MeWe by Mark C., who has been a guest on this program and who I got to have a nice walk through the woods and a couple of nice meals with over this past weekend. So the author is listed as the DUK, again, that's Daily UK News editor team, but in writing it, it's written in the first person, and the author identifies himself as somebody from India. But just to start with, over the past two decades, the global population of billionaires rose more than fivefold, and the largest fortunes rocketed past $100 billion. I started tracking this wealth, not for the voyeuristic thrill, but for warning signs. Rising inequality was becoming ever more a political issue, threatening to provoke popular backlashes against capitalism itself. The pandemic has reinforced this trend. As the virus spread, central banks injected $9 trillion into economies worldwide, aiming to keep the world economy afloat. Much of that stimulus has gone into financial markets, and from there, into the net worth of the ultra-rich. The total wealth of billionaires worldwide rose by $5 trillion to $13 trillion in 12 months, the most dramatic surge ever registered on the annual billionaire list compiled by Forbes magazine. The billionaire population boomed last year as well. On the 2021 Forbes list, which runs to April 6th, their numbers rose nearly 700 to a record total of more than 2,700. The biggest surge came in China, which added 238 billionaires, one every 36 hours, for a total of 626. Next came the U.S., which added 10 for a total of 724. The top 10 gainers in the U.S. and China each saw already vast fortunes grow in just 1 year by sums that not long ago would have seemed impossible in a lifetime, from $25 billion to more than $150 billion for Tesla founder Elon Musk. Okay, so I'm going to stop reading there. But Musk's, you know, the growth of his wealth basically reflected the enormous growth in the value of Tesla stock. It has since fallen down from its all-time high. And, you know, briefly, Elon Musk was the richest man in the world. But he took that title from Jeff Bezos on the way up, and he handed it back to Jeff Bezos on his way back down. So Jeff Bezos was and is the richest man in the world. Strange to think that I played air hockey with the guy. The author of this piece, he distinguishes between good billionaires and bad billionaires. Some billionaires just had it handed to them. They were born into it, but that's not most. Most billionaires made it, or, you know, acquired it themselves. And of the ones that he considers to be the bad billionaires, those are the ones who made their money from energy resources, oil, coal, natural gas, all that stuff, and mining, or in real estate, or in industries which lend themselves to corruption. And the so-called good billionaires, and he always puts good and bad in scare quotes, but the good billionaires are the ones who made their money in manufacturing and in tech. People who created something new. But then he starts talking about, you know, analyzing the role of billionaires, first by looking at their wealth as a percentage of their country's GDP. So billionaires as a class, in the 2010s, they held about 10%. Their combined wealth was worth about 10% of U.S. GDP. By 2015, it hit 15%. By 2020, it hit 20%. The wealth of all the billionaires in the U.S. equaled about 20% of U.S. GDP. Jeff Bezos, by himself, his net worth, is about 0.8% of the American gross domestic product, which is about half of what John D. Rockefeller's net worth was. His net worth was about 1.6% of U.S. GDP when he, you know, at the time, very early 20th century. But on a global scale, that's fairly mild. Carlos Slim, who is a telecom magnate in Mexico, his net worth is approximately 5.3% of Mexican GDP. And while the collective wealth of American billionaires is equivalent to about 20% of U.S. GDP, in Sweden it's 30%. One of the places with the least gross disparity between the wealthy and the poor, with among the smallest billionaire classes, is Japan. Which led me to wonder, I mean, we can look at vast inequalities and get angry about them, and we can see them as, you know, a problem, but Japan's economy is pretty stagnant, has been for a long time. Japan's population is aged. They stopped having kids. Their culture is definitely not dynamic. You may like anime, but anime is largely built with pieces of Western literature and Western film. But, you know, another word for stagnant, if you're talking about a stagnant economy and a stagnant culture, you can say it's not growing, it's not changing. Another word for that is steady state. They're not growth dependent. They're not struggling to formulate an identity. The Japanese national cultural identity is rock solid. They know who they are, and they're not worried about it. So maybe maybe calling them stagnant is prejudicial. And one other thing that I want to bring in here is, over the past couple of months, Bitcoin and, you know, in its shadow or in its wake, many of the other cryptocurrencies hit all-time highs. It was up over $62,000 for one Bitcoin. I cashed in a couple Bitcoins to buy the computer that I'm recording these words on. But there has been a lot of analysis of what has happened, because when Bitcoin, you know, it hit that all-time high of around $62,000 per coin, but then it went into free fall after Elon Musk announced via tweet that Tesla would not be accepting Bitcoin as payment for Tesla vehicles anymore because they were bad for the environment. Elon Musk has tens of millions of Twitter followers, and he is incredibly influential in the tech crowd, you know, the tech-centric crowd, also the Silicon Valley crowd, the space crowd, the electric vehicle crowd. You could say in the energy transition crowd. Elon Musk describes Tesla as a sustainable energy company, first and foremost, and part of that agenda is making cars. And so panic set in. And as the panic set in, the mainstream media reinforced the message that Elon Musk had put out. They recycled a four-year-old story about China announcing restrictions on cryptocurrency. But they didn't mention that it was a four-year-old event that they were reporting on. They were reporting as if it was brand new. So what's happening here? Why would Elon Musk make public statements that he knew was going to drive down the price of Bitcoin? And why would the mainstream media back him on that and further stoke people's fears? Well, imagine a seesaw. And on one side, you've got FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt. On the other side, you have FOMO, fear of missing out. The big institutional players, they manipulate the media, they manipulate the public conversation in order to favor either FUD at one instance or FOMO at another. Bitcoin had been going up and up and up, and people who hadn't been into it before, possibly people who had been skeptics before, saw that it was going up so high, they thought, I can't miss out on this, and they dumped their money into it. Well, you hit an all-time high, then you get the institutional investors and their servants in the media to feed fear, uncertainty, and doubt, to create a panic, you know, to create a stampede for the exits. The price falls to the floor. What happens then? The institutional investors buy up that Bitcoin, or, you know, the other coins as well, at fire sale prices, thus reinflating reinflating the asset. But what they've done in this process is they have sucked the money that the new investors brought into the market. They sucked all that out and collected it for themselves. They do this with stocks as well. I mean, that's what was going on with GameStop back at the end of last year. But with cryptocurrency, there's an added dimension to it. Decentralized finance, commonly referred to as DeFi, is a blockchain-based form of finance that does not rely on central financial intermediaries such as brokerages, exchanges, or banks to offer traditional financial instruments, and instead utilizes smart contracts on blockchains, the most common being Ethereum. Okay, I was just reading from Wikipedia there. I don't have that exact definition committed to memory. But think about this. Decentralized finance. Think about the privileged place that banks have. Central banks, but also privately owned banks, you know, like Goldman Sachs. When the Treasury Department issues new bonds, they do so through Goldman Sachs. I mean, they have a very privileged position. So there are sincere calls from both, you know, financial oligarchs, really, and elected representatives to ban Bitcoin and to ban cryptocurrencies, because cryptocurrencies allow people to make transactions and to perform financial operations without the government or their anointed representatives out in the, you know, the private banking sector. Of course, that's a threat. Of course, they would like it banned. But at the same time, those institutions are also acquiring lots of cryptocurrency, and they are creating products based on it. You can start a cryptocurrency-based Roth IRA if you want to. There aren't any on the New York Stock Exchange or the NASDAQ, but there are multiple cryptocurrency ETFs or exchange-traded funds on the Canadian stock market. And there surely will be. Multiple institutions have applied for permission to create cryptocurrency-based ETFs in American markets, and eventually they will be. One of them will be approved, and then that'll start, you know, that's the precedent. So the big institutional players, while they see the blockchain, they see cryptocurrency and decentralized finance as a challenge to their authority and to their privileged position, at the same time, they're not just going to sit back and watch it flourish and not catch a piece of it themselves. So what they do, you know, they buy cryptocurrency, they hold a lot of it. Tesla doesn't hold enough cryptocurrency. They don't hold enough Bitcoin, even if they just dumped all of their Bitcoin and sold all of it. They don't hold enough to change the price that much. Tesla doesn't hold enough Bitcoin to just dump it all and create a run for the exits. But announcing that they're no longer going to accept cryptocurrency or Bitcoin in particular as payment for their vehicles because of environmental concerns, well, that announcement carries a lot more weight. It grabs a lot more attention than just the price change that would result if they sold their very small, you know, in the grand scheme of things, holdings. But it's not just Tesla. Tesla made their announcement that they wouldn't be accepting Bitcoins anymore. This is very important. This date is very important. On May 13th of this year. Here's a CoinDesk article from May 11th of this year. It's called Bitcoin Pullback Risk Rises as Whales Resume Selling. This is by Omkar Godbole, and it's very short. I mean, it's basically one sentence and then a list of bullet points. Here's the sentence. Bitcoin's short-term prospects are looking a little bleak, with blockchain data pointing to renewed selling by whales, in scare quotes, large investors with the ability to influence markets. The number of whale entities, clusters of wallet addresses held by a single network participant holding at least 1,000 Bitcoin, fell to a 5.5-month low of 1,943 on Monday, according to data provided by Glassnode. So let's pause on that. When Bitcoin was up at $60,000 per coin, when it was at that price, 1,000 Bitcoins is $60 million. So the smallest whale to qualify, you know, the smallest participant holding Bitcoin to qualify as a whale at that time held $60 million worth of Bitcoin. In the weeks before Tesla announced that it was going to stop accepting Bitcoin as payment for their vehicles, institutional investors, whales, people holding at least 1,000 Bitcoin, started to sell. They were taking profits at that high. And clearly there was a coordinated effort, and it seems pretty clear that Elon Musk was in on it, to create a panic, you know, a run for the exits, which would cause the price to drop. Now, Bitcoin had been rising so much and so consistently for so long that they weren't just going to do a quick turnaround. They weren't going to create the panic, take some profits, and then buy back in a week or two. They want to really drive it down. they'd love to drive it down to, you know, $20,000. But eventually, these whales are going to get back in. They're going to buy up everything that they sold before and more at fire sale prices. But at the same time, they would still like to see Bitcoin banned. Why spend hundreds of millions of dollars to acquire something that you want to become worthless? Well, they're just hedging their bets. I mean, ideally, they would like cryptocurrencies and decentralized finance to go away. And, you know, if the governments could wave their magic wand and make it go away, they'd love to see that happen. But that's not possible. The government can ban it, but, you know, it's like banning drug use. You can't stop it. You can only punish people for doing it. But there's no demonstrable evidence that banning it reduces use. The Indian government is currently trying to ban Bitcoin. We'll see how that goes. You know, the Chinese government in 2017, they announced a lot of restrictions on the use of Bitcoin. But where are most Bitcoin mined? In China. Why? Because there's lots of cheap coal in China, and Bitcoin miners go to where electricity is cheap. Now, a quick aside here. Mining Bitcoin means doing these fiendishly complicated but ultimately pointless calculations in order to prove that the work has been done to create the Bitcoin. And this is just a way to allow the supply of Bitcoin to expand somewhat, but keeping it from expanding arbitrarily. So this is called the proof of work model for creating new Bitcoin. There are other currencies that have what's called proof of stake. And what proof of stake is, it's a concept that states that a person can mine or validate block transactions according to how many coins they hold. Again, I'm quoting Wikipedia here. Actually, this is Investopedia. This means that the more coins owned by a miner, the more mining power they have. Now, this seems kind of gross, right? This is like, oh, you mean whoever has the most coins gets to make more of them and nobody else does? Well, yeah, but here's how it works in practice. Lots of people get together and they create what are called stake pools. They pool their, in this case, I have Cardano in a pool, or ADA, running on the Cardano network. And that collected pool, it's as if it earns interest. The pool grows over time, and the growth of that pool is divided equally among all the people who have currency in it. So it's not just the big players who get more, you know, who get to benefit from the proof of stake. And this doesn't involve any of these fiendishly complex but ultimately pointless calculations done in support of the proof of work model that both Bitcoin and Ethereum use. Now, Ethereum is moving from proof of work to proof of stake late this year. They're getting away from that power consumptive model that Bitcoin still relies on. So now back to the oligarchy and, you know, the manipulation of the market by the whales. The whales are happy to create a panic, to drive down the price, to snatch up the investment money put in by noobs and, you know, basically the FOMO buyers, the people who saw the value of the asset, or, you know, at least the price of the asset increasing rapidly to unprecedented highs and thought, I got to get a piece of that. I can't miss out on that. So people who don't know anything about the market, they dump a lot of money. You know, maybe they dump half of their retirement savings into Bitcoin, and the whales just rub their hands together and they say, oh, we're going to take that. We're going to get that. You know, suppose you put half your retirement savings into Bitcoin when it's at $62,000, and 3 weeks later, it's at $32,000. You just lost half your money. Do you keep it there, or do you panic, sell, and get out? Most people who haven't been on the Bitcoin train very long, they have no visceral understanding of the volatility of this asset. Now, there is no 4-year period in the history of Bitcoin where somebody who bought Bitcoin and held it for 4 years lost money on it. But if you buy it at $62,000 in April of 2021, and by mid-May of 2021, it's down in the mid-30,000s, you're going to freak out. You know, if this is your first experience of Bitcoin, you're going to freak out. So when the whales pump it up to these new highs, they are luring in the FOMO money. And then when they intentionally crash the price, they're using fear, uncertainty, and doubt, FUD. They're bringing down the FUD hammer to drive away the new investors who drop their money and run. But this is something that you hear in, you know, if you follow cryptocurrency news, you haven't lost any money until you hit sell. If you bought in at 62,000 and you're holding it and the price is now $35,000, you haven't lost any money. You don't lose the money until you get out, until you convert your existing pool of cryptocurrency into fiat currency of whatever country you live in. At that moment, when you run, that's when you lost money. But if, I mean, are you investing your retirement savings in hopes of short-term gains? Who does that? If you hold it for at least 4 years, I mean, this is the historical pattern. If you hold it for at least 4 years, you will make money. That asset will increase, which isn't true of cash in the bank or cash in your mattress. That loses money every day. The spending power, the buying power of that cash in your mason jar buried in the backyard shrinks every day. Lots of investors are just looking for something to stave off the erosion of their capital. Yeah, a profit would be nice, but just a bulwark against inflation is what they're looking for. And cryptocurrencies absolutely provide that. Now, I'm not, anytime you watch anything on, say, YouTube about cryptocurrencies, anybody who says anything says, I'm not a financial advisor. Do not take this as financial advice. Well, duh. I'm not a financial advisor. I'm just some guy talking into a microphone about whatever catches his interest and making connections between seemingly unconnected areas of inquiry. What's the connection here between what I've been talking about? Populism versus the so-called liberalism of the Davos set. The Davos set, regardless of what country they come from, they have class solidarity. They have shared class interests. They identify with members of their class in other countries more than they identify with working and poor people in their own countries. They will manage the global economy, they will manage international relations, they will manage the public policy of their own countries and the supranational entities that administer nations from above. They will do all that to further the interests of their class. As George Carlin said, they don't give a shit about you. They don't care about you. They care about themselves and they care about the members of their class. And so you get people in Washington, D.C., on Wall Street, in New York City, who knowingly are stripping the money, the retirement savings from people who they helped lure into the cryptocurrency bubble. Now, to say it's a bubble means, implies that it's going to pop. And cryptocurrencies are volatile. But the networks that underlie them are the beginnings of decentralized finance, of breaking free from established institutions for doing normal financial transactions. It isn't anywhere close to mature. It's being built. And the whales would be happy to shut it down and in the process lose hundreds of millions of dollars that they put into crypto, but what do they care? What's hundreds of millions of dollars to them? Or if it does flourish, they bought in early in a big way, and they own a big piece of the decentralized financial networks, which are supposed to give people freedom from the official networks of financial institutions. Either way, the whales win. Going back to this article on CoinDesk, again, this is just a list of bullet points, and I'm not going to read all of them to you. Skipping down a little bit, from October 2020 to February 2021, the number of whale entities had risen in lockstep with Bitcoin's price. So late 2020 through early 2021, the price of the asset reflected the buy-in of the whales, validating the narrative that the rally over that period was the product of increased participation by large investors. Bitcoin's price has been generally restricted to the $50,000 to $60,000 range since mid-March, amid continued selling by whales. In other words, retail investors, a.k.a. the noobs, the FOMO buyers. Retail investors alone have been struggling to drive the rally. So from late 2020 through early 2021, the whales are buying in a big way, driving up the price. Then they stop, and they start to sell off. But the price doesn't drop because the FOMO buyers are still buying in. And then on May 13th, Tesla announces, it condemns Bitcoin for environmental reasons. And Elon Musk responds to somebody else's tweet. Somebody else was speculating that either Tesla had already dumped all its Bitcoin or it was about to, and Elon Musk commented on that tweet. He said one word. He said, "Indeed." Then the media starts recycling this story from 2017 about China restricting the use of Bitcoin in China, but not acknowledging that it's from 2017. Here's an article on CNBC. Its title is "China Bans Financial Payment Institutions from Cryptocurrency Business," published May 18th, 2021. Key points: China has banned financial institutions and payments and payment companies from providing services related to cryptocurrency transactions and warned investors against speculative crypto trading. Now, nowhere in the article does CNBC give the date or a time frame for these new moves by China against cryptocurrency. They don't announce a date when these things were announced. It's just implied that it was recently. Again, this is CNBC creating fear, uncertainty, and doubt to drive away the retail investors, the noobs, the normal people, the little guys, to drive down the price of this asset so the whales can get back in and basically collect all of that retirement savings. All of this money that was saved by normal people working jobs and setting aside some of what they earned so that they could live on it later in life. We are less than animals to the whales. To the editorial decision makers, the high ups in the corporate media, we are less than animals. We are fruits to be plucked. We are minerals to be mined. We are robots to be put to tasks until we're no longer useful and then discarded. They don't care about you. And I would say that for the most part, these people who don't care about you, who will rob you blind to enrich themselves further when they're already so rich they couldn't possibly spend all their money, they despise common people, they despise populism, and they are liberal. Does David Frum object to any of this? If he has objections, he certainly hasn't made any great effort to make them public. This is all business as usual. This is all fine for a champion of liberalism like David Frum. But hey, you can go anywhere with your smartphone, right? You don't actually have to have the means to travel to foreign locations. You can just look at your screen. Watching videos of people swimming in the Andaman Sea off of Thailand is just as good as doing it yourself, right? Okay, I'm drifting into a violation of my own policy of not rebutting a guest after the fact. So I'll stop. And I'll leave it there, because I could go on in this mode for a long time, but I think the message has been delivered. Thanks so much for subscribing. Thank you very much for supporting my ability to sit here and talk into this microphone. I really appreciate it, and I will do it again very soon. Talk to you then.